This event was recorded live as a part of the Cleveland Council on World Affairs Foreign Policy Forum. Ambassador Ronald Newman joined us to discuss the new Afghanistan policy. How new is it and what's it worth? Please visit ccwa.org to learn more about our upcoming speaker series programs.
Heather, thank you. Willie, thank you very much. Well, tonight's subject is Afghanistan. And, you know, what is the strategy and where is it going and what's its chances? I think it's useful to say at the beginning that Afghanistan is really complex. You've probably already noticed that. But I make the point because with a situation that is this complex, it's very easy to have a strong view and then adapt whatever facts you get to fit the view. And it doesn't really matter what the view is. You know, if you have a strong view that the war is good and we're winning, you can go to Afghanistan, you can sort of cherry pick the things that support your view, you can come back, write the article that said I was there and I've seen that this is the way it is. And if your view is 180 degrees out, you can do exactly the same thing. And, you know, after 18 years, people kind of get set in their ways and their thinking, too. So that this magnifies the tendency to simply write the position you had last year, which could be correct, but it's not conducive to thinking. So what I want to do tonight, rather quickly, is a brief reminder of why we're there, what the objective of the current policy is, and what the objective of three administrations has been, and then really to talk about what are the elements of that policy and what are their chances of success over what sort of general period. And I'm probably going to do that rather superficially because otherwise I would absolutely bury you and we'd be here at breakfast. But starting point. Remember, we went to Afghanistan because we were attacked in New York and we had 3,000 dead Americans, and that attack came from Afghanistan. And the Taliban, the Al-Qaeda movement that made it, was sheltered by the Taliban. It was the view of the Bush administration, it was the view of the Obama administration, and it is the view of the Trump administration that leaving Afghanistan will lead to a rebuilding of that threat and a base area for large-scale terrorism. There's a lot of argument and discussion that is possible to have about that. I'd be happy to do it, but it would take the rest of the speech. But that is the fundamental purpose. Now, in the Bush administration, we started with a very limited mandate, only do counterterrorism, don't do anything for stabilization, and we essentially wasted the first couple of years where we had the most freedom of action and where we probably could have done a great deal more to stabilize the situation. But we didn't. And, you know, that's also a casualty of going into a place you never intended to go and hadn't thought about going because you weren't intending to go there, and then you're in the middle of it and you're trying to invent the policy while you're running it. Gradually, the Bush administration policy broadened until it became probably excessive in its views of democratization. Obama tried to cut it back, but picked as the target only destroying Al-Qaeda, which brought us into a certain amount of absurdity, because in the last 2 years of the Obama administration, we'd pulled out combat troops and we decided that we were no longer at war with the Taliban. Now, they, of course, could continue to target us and did, so they could kill us any day of the week, and we could bomb them if they were attacking us or an Afghan city was going to fall, but otherwise the Afghan army was not supported by our Air Force for 2 years and didn't have an Air Force of their own. So they could kill us. Taliban could kill us any day of the week. We could kill them on alternate Thursdays if it fit our rules. This was not a brilliant policy. It was also undercut by the timelines. So Obama kept declaring timelines, and that both gave the Taliban reason to think we were going to leave. Pakistanis, the same idea. And it made a lot of Afghans on the government side very insecure. So we get to today. Trump comes in, President Trump, campaigns saying he doesn't sure he wanted to be there, thought maybe we ought to get out. Looked at this pretty hard and reversed his view, something that is not a notable feature of this administration so far. But he did. And he reversed it on the basis that we could not let Afghanistan become a threat again to ourselves and to our allies. Now, out of that, he developed with his staff a policy that is actually perhaps the most comprehensive policy we've had and probably the least well explained. We seem to be able to do this together. So let me just take a minute, though, to talk about the goal. We have a strategy. We have a very ill-defined goal. That's a problem because strategy is how you reach a goal. We spend too much time, I think, in this country, in the chattering class, talking about strategy when we really mean policy. Now, what's the strategy for Syria? And then somebody wants to talk about how many divisions you ought to have or not. Well, strategy is how you get to a place, but you have to know what the place is. You know, if you have no map, I suppose any road is good, but it's, you know, your strategy has to bring your ways and your means into alignment, and you can change strategy and have the same goal. You know, if the road's blocked, you can take a detour and get to the same place by going a different road. But that doesn't mean you change the goal. So we have a goal of preventing Afghanistan from becoming a threat to ourselves and our neighbors. We have not articulated that goal very broadly. But when you think about it, it actually has the seeds of a policy in it, but not one that we're frankly articulating. Because what that gives you is a policy of containing violence, keeping it out, keeping it under control, having an Afghan state and army that is sufficiently competent that it maintains a cap on the violence, prevents the insurgents from having a victory. Why don't we spell that out if that's a strategy? I don't really know. I submit that one problem is a major intellectual problem we have in America. I'm going to make a brief diversion to that and then talk about the policy. We are locked into a World War II paradigm of victory. What does victory look like? It's the surrender on the decks of the Missouri. You fight a non-state movement short of killing every single person who's got the wrong idea and is part of that movement, you don't get victory like that. And you're also dealing in non-state movements with movements that are regenerative. They rebuild. You don't get it's victory, you can go home. But if your only standard of victory is that surrender on the battleship, then you have defined a standard in which America has predetermined loss, failure, in every competition with every movement that threatens us that's not a state. It's not a very satisfying place to be. You've predetermined failure. And it's not sufficient, because how are you going to run a policy? You're just going to run around killing people? But that means you're going to have to find other goals that you can define as success without just making cute word games. You know, you say it's black is white. That's not what I'm talking about. So I think you can define success in Afghanistan as a long-running permanent state in which the Afghan government and army would be capable of maintaining sufficient control that you don't have threats to the United States and to our major allies coming out of Afghanistan. But it's not a clear victory. It's not an end. Could be with a great many fewer American troops. Probably will still need American money. There is a certain lack, well, if that's really the policy, which I think it is, it would be nice if we would have the gumption to talk more clearly to American citizens and say that's what it's about. And that means a long-term commitment. We've gone halfway there. We've said it's not conditional. It's not time constrained. We haven't said what it is, said what it isn't. But that's what you've got, I think, buried in this one phrase in the president's speech, is that we don't want a terrorist threat from Afghanistan again to the nation and allies. It means you have to contain it, but you have to get to a place where the Afghan state can contain it, because we can't do it forever. So then what are the pillars of that to reach that goal? They're basically a building of the Afghan security forces, a reform of governance in Afghanistan, some work on economics and a regional policy, and a kind of hope that you can get there by negotiations. But negotiations are a tool, they're not a policy. They're not a goal. Unless your goal is I'll sign anything, surrender, and get out, that I suppose would be a goal. But short of that, negotiations are a tool to reach an end. They're not an end in themselves. So within these four pieces, building security forces, Afghan internal politics, governance, economics, and a regional peace. The one that gets the most discussion, obviously, is the military. And the most frequent kind of shorthand bumper sticker phrase is, why do you expect to do any better now than you've done for 17 years? And the short answer is because we haven't done any one thing for 17 years. We had five different policies in the Obama 8 years alone. We only started seriously building the Afghan forces in 2010, and we quit building them effectively by 2014. You can't build a force in that level. So a lot of what you're doing now in sending this small number of people back is to do properly what we didn't do the first time, because we did a very shoddy job. We didn't resource it properly. We didn't spend enough time on it. Could work, might not work. It's not, nothing in this is guaranteed, and I don't want to sound like I'm suggesting that. But if you want to look around and say, is there any reason to believe this could work? Yes. You can look at the Afghan commandos, properly, generally reputed to be the best force in Afghanistan. Everybody who writes about it, talks about it, has noted that. Very rarely do people go on and say, well, why are the Afghan commandos the best force? Well, because they had a much higher density of special forces trainers to trainees. Instead of one for hundreds, you had one for tens. They spent more time on it, and they had a more literate force. You're not going to turn everybody in the Afghan army into commandos. But it is a demonstration that if you do the job right, which we definitely did not do, you can do it better. There are a lot of other pieces. So what you're seeing on the battlefield now doesn't actually tell you anything, pro or con. You got some people saying, oh, it's all failing. And you got other people saying, oh, no, watch how we're rolling them back. Well, you've got a very small additional increment of American combat troops, and it's a kind of a plug in the dike, because you're going to need 2 or 3 years for the kind of serious training that we didn't do before you're going to see an effect on the battlefield. And that's one of the things I criticize about the administration, is that it's not explaining to Americans that this is going to take a couple, 3 years. And after that, you should be able to judge. And there's some standards that I'm very aware of that we better be looking at really hard to judge if it's happening. But the impact of what we're doing in security is not what you're seeing on the battlefield now. It's what you will or won't see in a couple of years. The political piece is absolutely as important as the military, and it's in the Afghans' hand. They have to get better in their governance. They don't have to get really good, they have to get better. They have to get corruption and patronage under enough control that Afghans have a reason to believe in and fight for their own government. So that is probably the longest pole in the tent, the hardest part, to get an Afghan government that is really functioning. And if that doesn't happen, then the policy will fail. If you cannot build a government that people will support, then it does not matter how much training we do. But I don't think the jury's come back on that yet. There are, by the way, I go back to Afghanistan every year. It's sort of like malaria. It's not good for you, but it gets in the bloodstream. There were some very interesting things beginning. They're late. They should have begun years ago. But President Ghani, for you could say a lot of different things about him. Sometimes I do. But he is doing some very positive things. Now, they're all beginnings. They're none of them are where you can check the box and say this is done. But in the Army, one very interesting thing, they changed all the corps commanders last year. And for the first time, you can change commanders all the time, but for the first time, all the new corps commanders were combat-tested young brigadiers coming up out of the brigades instead of political generals parachuted in from Kabul. That's a significant change. Now we have to see if they're backed up as they do the hard work that's going to be necessary to clean up their units. They've made a major reform in the Ministry of Defense. It's been hard. It is functioning a lot better. It was interesting, President Ghani told me last summer that he could not do reform of the Interior Ministry and the Defense Ministry at the same time. It's an interesting statement of how much political opposition he had to overcome to work on defense. Now he's working on Interior. We'll see. That's a real cesspool. But they've fired a lot of people. They've sent several deputy ministers to jail. That's not a bad start. They could send a few more. There are a number of these small things. They've reformed the Civil Service Commission, brought in a bunch of younger folk out of the civil society world. And they're making some real changes, but they're taking aim at sort of the heart of the patronage network, and they're going to be opposed. They're going to, you know, that's not going to be fast work. It's an anti-corruption justice center that has now sent three major generals and five, I think, deputy ministers to prison for periods of several years and more. Again, that's not everything. That's not the highest. You know, all of these things are kind of like plants beginning to grow. You can see the shoots. You can't guarantee whether they're going to get blighted or grow. But all I would say to you is there's enough there not to be totally discouraged or say it's impossible. And it's a mistake to go further than that and say that it necessarily will succeed. There is room for economic growth if security improves. Afghanistan It's not a total basket case as we once thought. It has oil, gas, rare minerals, lithium, things people want for our batteries. They have to be able to exploit these things in ways that help the country, not sort of a repeat of Soviet breakup where a few oligarchs picked up everything and the country got very little. Very interesting. Ministry of Mines, and I'll quit talking about this, but it's a ministry which was so corrupt and so inefficient that all the foreign donors have stopped working with it. They have refused to work with it. Now, this last year, they have a new minister, a woman, probably middle 30s, very dynamic. She has identified one of her biggest jobs is to rebuild the ministry in a way that carries out respect. They've got a bunch of non-performing contracts, and she has to get on top of that. She's rebuilt her staff. She was just in Washington last week. We were talking to her. And one of the things she said was that it was an opportunity that was created out of a problem. Because the foreign donors wouldn't work in her ministry, she didn't have any foreign experts to fall back on. But she said, you know, if I had foreign experts, they'd have ended up doing the job, and then we wouldn't be all that much better off when they left. But because I didn't have any, I had to go out. And so she recruited a whole batch of younger Afghans that are now coming back into the country from education abroad with PhDs in meteorology, mineralogy? No, I'm not pronouncing that right. Mineralogy. Petroleum engineer, various things that ministry needs, and she's made them her directors. So now she's got this whole younger technical staff that wants to learn. Or with the older staff, you bring in the foreign advisors, and it's sort of like, these people are a threat to my position, you know. How do I handle them or keep them away from my real sideline business or whatever? And so now she's got a very new staff. Well, we'll see if she can pull this off. Again, you know, to do what she needs to do, she's going to have to take a lot of corrupt contracts away from people. this is going to be tough sledding. I hope somebody doesn't shoot her. But that's what, these things have to happen. So the jury's out on those too. But there is economic potential. And then you've got this new, the policy is set in a regional piece, which the biggest piece is the pressure on Pakistan. That's a much heavier pressure than we ever imposed before. Pakistan does have sanctuaries that the Taliban refit in. They don't all come out of Pakistan, but they have incredibly important support in Pakistan. And some of the most devastating things, particularly the big suicide truck bombs and the individual suicide vests, are mostly built in Pakistan. And a lot of those kill Americans, and I kind of resent that. So there is a new level of pressure on Pakistan. I don't know if it will work. There has been pressure on Pakistan before. Pakistanis have their own reasons for being involved in Afghanistan, strategic purpose as they see it. To get that policy to even have a chance, there are about three things that will have to happen. One is, it has to be clear to the Pakistanis that we think we're going to stay and see this through. Because if we're going to leave, then they will have a very high pain tolerance, because at the end of the day, they think they have to protect their own interests, and they think the Taliban does that. If they think we're staying and things are improving, that need isn't the same. The pressure on them is going to have to be sustained, and it may blow up in our face. And it will need a certain amount of regional political pressure. And frankly, nothing is fast. There isn't a single thing I can tell you in Afghanistan, no matter how positive, that is going to solve anything tomorrow. Sorry about that. But you have a comprehensive policy. So let me get to the end so we can ask questions. But what I would say to you is that this is now a period where the discussion should no longer be about policy for a couple of years. It should be about the execution of policy. We are very policy focused. For one thing, it's a lot easier to talk about policy because it's hard to get close enough to talk about execution. But the reality is that success or failure now is going to come out of execution. And when you do constant debates about policy, you cause insecurity about where you're going. Nobody's sure of what you're doing. You hold things up, and we've done this several times. And then you start off in a new direction, and you don't finish one thing you were started. You go off and do something else. And sometimes that could be correct. Sometimes the problem will be in policy. But a lot of times the problem is in execution of policy, in implementation, which we don't really teach much from an academic perspective. But take one example from Afghanistan. Big piece of the policy, vital part, rebuilding the Afghan security forces. Now, we can have properly trained personnel to train the Afghans. We can leave them long enough in country that they build up relationships so they're trusted. We can listen to the Afghans and understand their problems. We can not quite be the special forces, but we can do that kind of intensity of training. We could probably produce a pretty good result. We can do what we've done before, send trainers with minimal formation and training in how to be trainers, rotate them quickly, make sure you have little chance to build up any personal relationships, try to rush the program, do it faster than is at all possible, and we'll have large-scale failure. Policy will be the same. Policy is build the Afghan security forces. The difference between great success, total failure, and any number of options in between is all about the execution of policy. It's not about having the policy right. And so when you look at a policy with a military piece, a political piece, an economic piece, and a regional piece, and you know that every one of those pieces is going to take time, there's a need to resist the 24-hour news cycle for judgment. And this is hard. You know, people say, yeah, okay, I understand, long term. It's been 3 days. What's happened? If you do that, you probably increase the chances of failure. So have a policy, not guaranteed, but it's probably the most comprehensive we've had, has a strategic rationale, and it's going to need some time. And success is not guaranteed, but we can increase the chances of failure by messing about with it daily. So let me stop there, having raised your confusion to a new level of detail, and I'll be happy to try to take your questions. Thank you.
We have two microphones, and so raise your hand, and they will get to you.
20 minutes.
Was it? Okay.
Am I responsible for picking
them? They will find
them. You'll find them. Okay. Then
the question's here. No. James Mattis was recently in the region on visit to Oman, asking the Sultan to kind of resolve the Gulf crisis. The Taliban has an office in Qatar. Is his visit a little bit of a timely visit? And does it have any correlation to maybe the strategy that you talked about today for Afghanistan?
I don't think General Mattis was involved with the Taliban office in Doha. I think there are some efforts to revitalize peace talks. There have actually been a lot of, people say there's no effort. That's not quite true. There has been a fairly heavy effort, both in the Obama administration and even in this one. The biggest, a major problem has been that up to now, the Taliban wants to talk to the Americans and they do not want to talk to the Afghans. Well, in the end, peace, if you're going to have a real peace that isn't just surrender, it's going to have to be between Afghans. The only thing the Americans have really to give is we can pull out the troops and end the support for the government, leaving them sort of more at the Taliban's mercy. But if we were to say we would only negotiate, we would meet their condition, we would begin the negotiations with them now. That would be a huge political victory. But I think at this point, they haven't yet got reason to believe that we will stick to this business or that they can't win, and they haven't made a decision. I can't say whether they will. General Mattis made a kind of cryptic comment about some elements in the Taliban maybe being willing to negotiate. I don't know what he meant. There are a couple of potential explanations. The Taliban itself is a very divided movement. And I know a couple of people who have been dealing, Westerners, but who've been dealing with Taliban for years, who believe that you could draw off, that it's more likely that you could draw off some people at the bottom who are fighting for tribal reasons and other things, that you could more likely make peace with them and pull them off the battlefield than to make some kind of global negotiation. So General Mattis could have been talking to them, to those experts, could be reflecting that, could be just an analytical comment that there are fissures in the movement. I don't expect to wake up and get a headline about a breakthrough tomorrow.
Mr. Ambassador, a quick question. How would you relate the Indian and Chinese influence in the region and what dynamics that will portend?
I have an opportunity to make you even more confused than you were before. Well, let me see if I could do that in short form and simply. The Pakistanis are paranoid about the Indians. Now, in fairness to Pakistanis, remember that even paranoids have real enemies. But they see Indians behind every bush. They are convinced that if Afghanistan falls apart, the Indians will take advantage of that, and Pakistan will be encircled and double threatened. They resent anything we do with the Indians. The fact that India is, just as a matter of fact, is probably more important, bigger market, other things, democracy, that doesn't cut any ice with the Pakistanis. So our administration has kind of waved out doing more with the Indians in Afghanistan as a way of bringing pressure on the Pakistanis. That is an interesting policy because on the one hand, it if done very carefully, it might bother them a little. But it might also scare them so much that they intensify their support for the Taliban. It's a very risky path to go down, particularly when you talk about two countries in a, you know, always on some kind of conflict that both have nuclear weapons. So you really want to be careful what you do trying to use Indian influence in Pakistan. Chinese are very close to the Pakistanis. They have a deeply long-developed relationship, very important one. Chinese are engaged, as you've probably seen, in this One Belt, One Road building, enormous, you know, billions and billions of dollars being invested in all kinds of infrastructure around the world. One big piece of that support in Pakistan. But it's a couple of elements. The Chinese are concerned about the war. They have Muslim insurgents in eastern Afghanistan, and they don't want that to grow. They don't like that corridor. They would like to see a negotiated peace, and they've worked a certain amount on that in the last few years. But there is no evidence that the Chinese will put any real pressure on Pakistan. So they would support a peace movement, but they may not press them against it. For a long time, they just were completely inactive. And I remember a few years ago, I was at a conference in Beijing, and there was a professor, Wang Jianzi, who is now a senior political advisor in the Chinese government. And he said to me about Chinese policy, he said, I think you can anticipate cautious passivity. Well, then about a year after that, they got actually much more active. They started taking a role in peace negotiations. They got more concerned. They don't want to see failure in Afghanistan, but they're just not going to jeopardize their relations with Pakistan through really heavy pressure. They've got too many other eggs in the Pakistani basket. So I think with China, you see great interest, but limited influence. They could be very supportive if things move toward peace, but they're not going to push them to get there. Who's got the next one? I love this, having somebody else take responsibility for who gets the questions.
Yes, I have several questions, but the first one maybe we'll start with the Taliban, because you talked a lot about the policy, the goal, but not much about the Taliban, the enemy, or at least the extremist portion of the Taliban, that is the Al-Qaeda, whatever is left of Al-Qaeda. Because if the goal is to avoid having any terrorist activity against the United States, let's again talk a little bit more about the Taliban. How large are the Taliban within Afghanistan? What do they want? What is their ideology? And what do they want by peace negotiations with the United States? Did you catch up with the New York Times article today on Afghanistan?
Today, no, I was traveling.
Okay, well, essentially they summarized pretty much what you said, and all our options are bad, including the ones that you mentioned, because it's costing us $45 billion a year with all the uncertainties that you mentioned. Sounds like rebuilding a country again. But go back to the Taliban and explain what, you know, the enemy, what is it, what do they want, so forth. Thanks.
And probably not in more than 5 minutes. Okay. Let me, there were a lot of questions in that piece, but you were fair, you said there were. Let me try to deal with many of them. Because the Taliban is not one thing. It is an umbrella alliance, and we, in at least public discussion, we often oversimplify that. So, at the political level, that is the descendants of Mullah Omar and the core leadership of the Taliban, what they want is an Islamic emirate in Afghanistan without the current constitution, governed by Sharia law. And this is completely public. They actually have a very effective public information or propaganda service, and they're quite clear about this. Now, what does that mean then? there you start moving into a lot of interpretations. And frankly, these are not areas they have ever clarified. They have no interest in clarifying them because you don't clarify doctrinal disputes and hold your movement together. And if you're going to negotiate, you want to hold those things in reserve. But they have been totally opposed to the Afghan government position, which is become a political party and join the political process, but accept the basic constitution, although there could be changes, and accept things like the rights of women. Taliban makes little noises about how they might do that. Within the Taliban, you have various splits. You have a lot of local commanders. We've killed a lot of middle-level local commanders, and there's some reason to believe that some of those who've come up from the ranks and taken their place are probably ideologically more radical than the ones we've killed. That's probably not a good thing. A big piece of the Taliban is the Haqqani movement, which is based on a tribe, the Zadran tribe in eastern Afghanistan. The Haqqanis have been active in the wars against the Soviets. They have a long history. They have built a large empire of smuggling, drugs, kidnapping for ransom. But there is also evidence that the founder of the movement, Siraj ad-Din, who's not really in charge anymore, as he passed the rule to his son, Jalal ad-Din, that there is a certain amount of evidence that they have become more ideologically hardline. Whether that is true of every Haqqani, that's probably not true. But there is some evidence that along with this mixture of criminal stuff and desire for tribal control, you also have greater ideological fixation. I think I probably bore everybody if I start going down through every piece. But now, what is the relationship between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban? They are still allies. They have protected each other on the battlefield. There are not as many of them. I don't think any of our numbers are worth much, quite honestly. Last year, we found a rather largish, like 300-400 people, Al-Qaeda base in Afghanistan, which had been there for about 6 months and we hadn't picked it up. So I don't have a lot of faith that our intelligence is perfect. But Al-Qaeda was allied with the Taliban before the New York bombing. They've never broken that tie. There's some interesting stuff that was seized in the computers after Osama bin Laden was killed. And at one point in the computers, there are some letters that he's writing to subordinates. And he said, you know, he's not really, you know, this is the Al-Qaeda great leader. And he's saying to one of his people that I'm not quite sure what those Taliban guys are doing right now. You know, is our alliance solid? But go talk to the Haqqanis because we can really trust them and they work with us closely. Now, that's a couple of years ago. But you know, the evidence is that cooperation continues. Now you have another element, if I didn't confuse you sufficiently, with the rise of the Islamic State coming into Afghanistan. It's not terribly big yet, but it's been big enough that nobody's been able to suppress it. It is more Afghan and a place for Taliban dissidents who are more radical can go. It has not yet shown a lot of evidence that you're getting Arabs or Punjabis or others coming in. But you have two things going on. One is you have this even more radical movement trying to embed itself in Afghanistan. And at the same time, you have an ideological issue. That one of the things that caused the split between the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda was that the Islamic State went for owning territory, for becoming a real state, not just an underground movement. And that was something which the Taliban leadership said was a mistake. Well, what is the impact of the destruction of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria? It is to validate the approach of the Taliban. So if you're talking of Al-Qaeda, sorry. So if you're talking about where does this wave of radicalism go with a lot of destruction of the Islamic State, one natural pole is Al-Qaeda. It's been shown that its analysis was correct. And at the same time, if you bail out of Afghanistan, what do you have? You have the final victory. God is on our side. We defeated the Americans as well as the Soviets. I don't know where we pay for that, but I don't believe you can just run around other places fighting Al-Qaeda and think that you can avoid the enormous propaganda boost that would come with failure. That's one reason we have three lousy choices. Now, maybe you can make four or five lousy choices. Because it really is a big price to deal with if we fail. I don't know if I've answered your question, but hopefully I've touched on at least a few pieces of it.
It's me, Ambassador Newman. Welcome to Cleveland.
Thank you.
I'm a former colleague of yours, former retired Foreign Service officer, so welcome. And welcome to the students from Andrews Osborne Academy. I hope from this talk you'll get an interest in foreign policy. The State Department exam is free. You can take it as many times as you'd like. And we certainly need young people coming into the business. But you touched a couple times on nuclear weapons. And I just wondered if you wanted to talk to us a bit about the Iran nuclear deal. Because we've heard that the Secretary of State, former Tillerson, left because he disagreed with President Trump on the deal. And that the new Secretary of State agrees with President Trump on renegotiating that deal. And then also recently, we've heard that the Saudi crown prince has said that if Iran gets nuclear weapons, well, Saudi Arabia wants nuclear weapons, too. So just how do you see the future of this Iran nuclear deal? Do you think we should try to keep it as much as we can, or try to renegotiate it? And my last question is, who is in charge of nuclear nonproliferation at the State Department right now? Because all the folks I knew who were experts in it seem to have gone.
Another simple question. Okay. I don't propose to do a whole talk on the Iranian nuclear deal, but and cards on the table, I support maintaining it. We had a number of years. Well, first of all, let me go back. I do believe the Iranians were working on building a nuclear, the work toward a nuclear weapon. There's evidence that they stopped that program about 2003, but I worked on some of that stuff when I was director of the Iran-Iraq office after the first Gulf War, and the evidence, to my mind, was quite strong about what they were doing. With a lot of sanctions, but we only got effective sanctions on Iran when we also began to open up the possibility of negotiations, because effective sanctions required other countries buying in. Our unilateral sanctions alone never had enough pull to hurt the Iranians badly enough to move them. When we opened up the possibility, at least intellectual, that we could have some form of agreement, we were also able to bring in the Europeans, the Russians, the Chinese. That's when you got effective pressure. Out of that, after a couple of years of work and 170 pages of agreement, I'm told, you got an agreement that totally prevents them from having a nuclear weapon, and then it puts a number of restrictions on them, some of which have timelines and will go away, some of which, in terms of limits on some of their nuclear capacity and inspections, don't go away for 25 years. And so the crux of the argument is whether this is an inadequate deal, as President Trump says, or whether it is, if not perfect, good enough. Because, you know, in diplomacy, you always have to deal with not what is the perfect, but what can you get or what do you lose? So, you know, and that always means you're dealing in gray areas and it's not perfect and nobody's happy with whatever you do. But if America walks away from the nuclear deal by itself, the Europeans have been absolutely explicit that they will not join us in putting on sanctions. Neither will the Russians, neither will the Chinese. You will not have a sanctions tool that is worth much. You can put sanctions back on. The only way you'll have one that really works is if you use the fact that the American banking system controls a great deal of the international flow of money. If we insist on putting U.S. domestic laws in force against all our major allies and acting against their banks and financial institutions if they trade with Iran, then you can really hurt our allies along with Iran. But then you may also provoke a backlash that ends up creating new institutions that bypasses. But otherwise, I don't think you can get where President Trump wants to go the way he's going. But what they seem to be trying to do now is to say, okay, we won't entirely break out of this thing if you, the Europeans, will work with us in putting more pressure on Iran in order to fix some of the things we see are broken, particularly limitations on missiles. Well, it's an interesting effort. We'll see how much they're prepared to offer, as well as how much they want to get from the Europeans. There's an ongoing discussion now. I don't know where that's going. If we just walk out of the agreement, I think it's a bust. I don't think it will. For one thing, if we walk out of the agreement, there is nothing to stop the Iranians from going back to work immediately on building a weapon. That's what all the inspections and all the restraints are part of the agreement. So if we break the agreement, we leave the Iranians a choice. They can either walk out of the agreement and go back to work, and we were estimating they were maybe a year away from producing a nuclear weapon. So instead of having another 7 years before they could even start, and probably another 20 before the inspections would keep, before the lack of inspections would keep you from knowing what they were doing, you can have a year. I don't know why that's an advantage, but some people think it is. That's not fair. Obviously, they think it wouldn't happen. Or the Iranians may say, well, the Americans have welched on their deal, but we're going to keep it anyway. In which case, the Europeans will all say, we're going to continue to trade with Iran. We're all keeping the deal along with the Russians, the Chinese. The Americans will have then isolated themselves, not the Iranians. I don't think either one of those choices are where we want to be, but obviously I'm giving you a somewhat one-sided view because I think that breaking the deal is bad news. It also has a Korean complexity. How do you negotiate? Now we say we're going to have a negotiation, or at least we're ready to have a negotiation. I don't know if the North Koreans are. But it's a very interesting exercise to say, we're willing to negotiate with you, the North Koreans, and your basic point is you want to make sure your regime is secure if you give up your nuclear program. They may never give it up, but that's the basic thing they say. So how do you say we're prepared somehow to meet this goal that your regime is threatened, but at the same time, by the way, we're just breaking the agreement we made with the other guys about their nuclears? It's not a basis on which you build confidence with somebody that you can negotiate with them. Now, whether they'll negotiate with us, I have no idea. But as to the last part of your question about who's in charge, this policy is basically being run out of the White House. I don't know whether it makes a difference whether Pompeo is in the White State Department or Mr. Tillerson. I do know that it is important that the president do his homework before he gets into negotiations. And I'm not going to totally say you mustn't ever do a negotiation without being surrounded. The normal way is you want to prepare an agreement, you want to have experts meet, you want to know where you are before you walk in the room with your top decision maker and sign off on something. But, some of the biggest breakthroughs we had in arms control were Reagan and Gorbachev. Now, Reagan had been thinking about this stuff a little longer than President Trump has, and President Reagan had George Shultz with him, a little different cast of characters, but still you had a very different model. So will the president do his homework? Will he know what pitfalls are? I don't know yet. They can reach out and get expertise if they want it. They don't have a whole lot left in the U.S. government. And we have one other problem among many, which is the State Department under Secretary Tillerson was determined to reduce the size of the department. They wanted an 8% reduction, of which 12% was to come out of the civil service, 4% out of the foreign service. Each was to be reduced, one by 12%. Now, when you look at the civil service, I've been more concerned about the foreign service because I can see the statistics on that. But when you look at the civil service, where are they concentrated? They're concentrated in what we call the functional bureaus. These are the people who do arms negotiations. These are the people who do technical negotiations over telecommunications standards. These are the people who do the trade negotiations, at least the State Department component. These are the people who do all of the technical fields. Well, if you're reducing the civil service by 12%, you probably haven't got enough secretaries to fire to get to 12%. So what you're going to thin out is all your technical expertise, including in your Arms Control Bureau. So whether the State Department has anybody left who really knows the history of arms control and can work on this stuff, I don't know. So who's got a simple question?
I don't know how simple it is. What do you see as the consequences of the recent changes in cabinet position as it affects Afghanistan?
And with a due footnote that it's pretty early to tell, I don't think these changes really affect Afghanistan. I think they affect a lot of other things. But the administration took quite a few months to get to this policy that I was describing. Pompeo tends to be harder line than Tillerson in many ways, so I don't think he's going to be the man to advocate bolting out of Afghanistan. I can't say on a broader level, you may not like the policy changes that come from Tillerson to Pompeo. On the other hand, on a management basis, it may get much better. I have to, so that you understand my biases, I have to tell you that the very impolite and uncivilized way in which Mr. Tillerson was fired does have a certain ironic element, because it's exactly the way they've been kicking his professionals out of the State Department. So I have a certain feeling that what goes around has come around, and you'll just have to pardon me or not for taking a certain satisfaction in the brutality of his dismissal. But whether that gets you better policy, another question. But I think it may be more likely to affect issues like Iran or maybe Korea than it will Afghanistan.
Last two questions.
Mr. Hoy.
Very simple question.
Uh-huh.
So what's your outlook about the future of Afghanistan in the next few years? Political outlook.
Well, I have a great deal of optimism about the younger people for the long run if they can survive their leaders in the short run. There really is a new generation that didn't exist when we went into Afghanistan that has come out of schools and universities both in the West and in Afghanistan, including an American university in Afghanistan, which underwent a horrible terrorist attack almost 2 years ago. 13 students killed and one beloved Afghan professor who had a Rhodes Scholarship and was about to depart the next week for Oxford. But they've rebuilt, they've reopened. The students have all come back. And in fact, last time I was in Afghanistan, when I was meeting the foreign minister, his note taker was a graduate from that university. So there's a lot. It could really take off. And it could just not break out of the internecine fighting between political leaders. You could have a terribly fraudulent election and a replay of the kind of crisis you had last time, only this time I don't think we're going to try to walk in and solve it. And if it gets out of control and they went to shooting, they can just completely destroy what they've got. I don't think any prediction is worth a Billy Damn, because you have these somewhat finely balanced policies. Now, I think we've got a couple of years, a year, to work on heading off a crisis. I don't think we'll have a great election, but every Afghan I know says it doesn't have to be good, it just has to be better. You've got a lot to work with in the younger people. You've got progress going on in removing some of the level of corruption. But none of those things are guaranteed. So you could be looking at something a great deal better in 10 years. I don't think you could be looking at something worse than having us there, because I don't think we'd stick that long. I wish I could give you a definitive answer, but I think it would be a propaganda talking point and not an analysis.
What do you think of the effectiveness of General McChrystal's counterinsurgency, the COIN program that he implemented?
I believe General McChrystal's counterterrorism, counterinsurgency policy, you have to look, the part where you're talking about counterterrorism, which is the strike package, what he did, for those of you who are not familiar with this, General McChrystal, first in Iraq and then in Afghanistan, built up a system of using special forces tightly coordinated with intelligence, much higher operational tempo of raids, and much more rapid utilization of the intelligence got from those raids. Sometimes they were even able to mount a second raid in the same night based on that kind of intelligence. That was tremendously effective. And it was effective in Afghanistan. But what you're doing there is tactical. It's not strategic. Doesn't change the strategic picture. It kills people, but these are all replaceable people over time. It doesn't end a war. It can quiet it. It can immobilize things for a time until they rebuild, but it is tactical. And General McChrystal totally realizes that. I didn't know him before he went to Afghanistan. I met him there on one of my early trips. I was impressed by how much he had learned and was willing to learn. What he undertook in Afghanistan was much different than his counterterrorist piece, which was his whole background. It was a much more comprehensive effort. But he had to operate within these totally artificial timelines of the Obama administration. Now, I think he made a judgment that it could be done, but I think when he made that judgment, he didn't understand how little he had to work with on the Afghan side, because they just weren't ready. I mean, under McChrystal's effort to meet the Obama timelines, they identified 80 districts that were key, and 40 of them were supposed to be stabilized in 1 year and the next 40 in the second year. There were no Afghan administrators in 2010 to even pick that up. So you could send foreigners in, but you couldn't keep what you had, and you couldn't govern what you had. And the Afghans knew that. And I think General McChrystal knows it now. He may have known it then. But he had his orders, and he did the best he could, and I have a lot of respect for what he did. But the idea that you can do counterterrorism for 3 years and quit just doesn't pass the laugh test. I think that's it. Thank you very much.